For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
It's Genesis 9. The flood is in history now. It's behind them. Things are moving forward in the plan of God in history. God is the Lord of history. Nothing makes that clearer than the book of Genesis. Genesis is so important because of it's foundational in terms of painting this picture of who is God and what is God about. And there's a pattern that we have seen in the book of Genesis that is characteristic, really, of the pattern of God's dealing with people and with the cosmos throughout the scriptures. And it kind of goes like this, this theme of God blessing out of the failure of his creation. And from every major scene that makes up the drama of Genesis, we've seen this. So that God blesses Adam and Eve, creates them uniquely in his image, places them in the garden, enters into a covenant with them that anything that they want, they have access to, except that there's a tree, the knowledge of good and evil, that he says, no, don't go there. Trust me with your life, even though you're a free choosing being and you can go the other way, choose to stand with me on this. No, said Adam, we're going to go our own way. Cain, a failure, slays his brother Abel. Then there is the flood. Then there's the incident at the Tower of Babel as the nations are dispersed because they're in collusion against God himself. Lots of failure going on, but in each occasion of significant defining failure comes an opportunity for God to bless, and that's exactly what he does. So even though Adam rebels, that he brings humanity into a state of death, there's the promise in chapter 3, verse 15, that there would be an ancestor born, a seed, as it were, who would exact retribution against God's enemy and man's enemy, and that this rift between man and God would be resolved. And that seed promise goes through Seth, through Noah, and ultimately through Abraham, as we'll talk about next week. But in each case, the point is, human failure is met with God's abundant, gracious blessing. Why? Because that's the God we deal with. That is the God who is there. And tonight we talked last time about the flood. That's bad news. When God has to move in judgment over his own creation, beings that he created in his own image, we wonder what could be left for humanity. And what could be left for the cosmos? And what could be left for the earth destroyed by flood? And that answer comes to us in the passage that we're going to study here this evening. It says, beginning in the context here of Genesis 9, verse 1, God blessed Noah and his family, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Now, if you've been reading along with Genesis, that's a familiar sounding formula, isn't it? When God created Adam and Eve, he said, be fruitful and multiply. It was God's intent to bless them, and that in blessing comes abundance, comes fruitfulness, comes expanse, growth. That is the way of blessing. And God, in this passage then, right after the flood, God is going right back to the beginning, to what his intent for humanity was all along. That hasn't changed. I want to move toward my creation with blessing, and I want them to be fruitful, and I want them to multiply. And then he goes on from there. And it says in verse 10, God spoke to Noah and his sons, saying, behold, I'm establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you. He says, I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. Then the bow is in the cloud, the ark in the cloud, and I will call upon it to remember the everlasting covenant, the rainbow. Here it is, my covenant with you, three times in verse 10, 11, and 16. God's covenant. What kind of covenant? An everlasting covenant. not a temporary deal. This is a clear intent of what God intends. For who? He says, for Noah. For you. Not just Noah, for all flesh. He says, your descendants, every animate object, and indeed even the earth itself. And so God now is covenanting with his creation. And so what we want to do is unpack that a little bit. We want to think about that because this is really kind of an extraordinary statement for God to make. This covenant, what does it mean? What is it about? Most centrally, it's about his creation. It's about the earth and all of the things that live on the earth. And from this perspective, and it's an important one, the Bible is declaring that nature matters. Nature is significant. And we need to understand this a little bit if we're to understand the breadth of biblical spirituality and understand exactly what God's intent in salvation is. Ultimately, this is the direction that we're going to go. This is a big part of the story of what God is seeking to accomplish in history. God cares about nature. Let's think about this from the standpoint of common imbalances in this area of nature, of matter, material objects, and its relationship to the spiritual. Because this question of how does the spiritual relate to the physical is really a part of all religious thinking. And the Bible presents a very unique and powerfully persuasive point of view on this. Let's think about this for a minute. Most of the world's religion, through most of human history, has deified nature. Whether it's animism or polytheism, the idea is that essentially that nature is personified by spiritual individuals, gods of rain, gods of the crops, gods of animals, all kinds of things like this. And that ultimately then, nature is the final reality. And when that is the case, and this is the important point, if nature is the ultimate reality, and it is worthy of our all, humans are diminished. When we elevate nature to the level of deity, we necessarily diminish humans. Why is that? Let's think about that. We see the same thing in both in ancient paganism, the very cultural climate that Moses is writing Genesis in, which was absolutely a polytheistic, animistic culture, worshiping rocks and trees, the storm, the crops, everything. But also, and this is also very important, the ultimate understanding of reality, the ultimate belief in what is real today is also material. We live in a materialistic culture. Now, by that, I don't mean greedy, although it's that often as well. But material, like all that exists, is matter, acting on matter, according to the laws of nature. And when we envision the world either as nature alive with spirits or just matter itself, it must diminish humanity. Why is that? Because, think about this, if nature is calling the shots, if nature defines what the rules of conduct are, what are those rules? Nature is cruel. Everyone has understood this from the earliest days. That's why pagan religions came into being as a way to personify and therefore find a way to placate or tame the angry forces of nature operating against men. And so in the bottom left-hand corner, you see this, the charred remains of thousands of children offered in sacrifice to the animistic gods of ancient Ashkelon in Canaan, the land that ultimately the Jews took over, became Israel. And we think, well, that's just crazy. I mean, that's primitive people in their place of desperation doing terrible things. But that upper right-hand column, that's a picture right from Cambodia, reflecting what was done there in the 1970s and the early 80s under the explicitly atheistic communist regime of Pol Pot, in which people don't matter in any way. What matters is the movement of history and of economic relationships. People are just expendable. And so they were sacrificed by the tune of about 25 to 28% of their entire population, just completely eliminated. We think, how could this happen? These people are clearly, you know, crazy, they're wrong, they're immoral. And we say, yeah, okay, by what standard? Who says? And the reality is, and this is a super important point for modern technological American culture. Look, there are many things that we are capable of doing, remarkable things and really awful things. But if we're only looking to nature to determine for us what we should do, we are absolutely without moral compass. We have no guidance whatsoever other than the basic principles that seem to govern the law of the jungle, which is the survival of the fittest. Justice is the interest of the strongest. And so that's a real problem, and humanity is diminished when nature becomes the ultimate. And it is in that context that the Bible presents something profound and fundamentally different than anything that has ever been seen then or really since. Nature is an insufficient model for human rights and human dignity. But then on the other side, too, there's a problem, and we're going to explore this a little bit later, but the point needs to be made here. But there is also that tendency to denigrate nature. And what I mean here is just the idea that, well, what really matters is the spiritual. Nature's just sort of there, and it can be exploited for whatever reason. And so when nature is diminished, it is reduces really just to an exploitable commodity. And you see, that's what colonialism was really all about in the 18th and the 19th century, really even into the 20th century, that vast tracts of land that just happened to have people living on them are there for the sake of our own plunder, for their mineral resources, their lumber, whatever it is that they've got that we want, at whatever cost, it doesn't matter. And that is a problem as well, as we'll see. So nature matters to God, not because it's the ultimate, but for a different reason, an important reason, and it is because that it reflects who God is. That's the important part of it. Let's think about this just for a second. In each of the six creative days in Genesis 1, God says, it was, and it was good. That's the formula. That's how each of those six creative days are framed. And it was good. That's right. Nature is good because it is a reflection of who God is. And so humanity, as the crown of creation, uniquely in the image of God, also is a part of the natural order. And so in the biblical frame of reference, humanity is a biological creation of God, but also that there is a spiritual element, and that both of these things, while different in terms of substance, as it were, that spirit and matter are different things, in a human being, they come together to form a composite. Humanity is, by definition, a physical being and a spiritual being completely connected with one another. That's what it means to be human. And that becomes later in our discussion as well. But that's an important thing that we begin with. We're not just spirits that are trapped inside of a body that need to be released. It was God's intent from the very beginning that we have a body that reflects in an important way who He is, and that we relate to Him as spiritual beings that are fully embodied. Nature matters. It reflects the image of God. The Bible just repeatedly says that it's important to us in terms of our own spiritual life, in terms of our own understanding of God, that we behold Him through the lens of nature. It produces awe, the grandeur of God. If we appreciate that, produces a humility, a gratitude, a curiosity that are so fundamentally important to being a person, to be the kind of person that God created us to be, that reflect His image. Let's look at a few psalms that kind of point this out. Psalm 8 is such a wonderful psalm. He says, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is Your name in all the earth. When I consider Your heavens, the work of Your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained? What is man that you take thought of him? Isn't that wild? The vastness of the universe. And the more, of course, we learn, the more intricate that becomes. An incredible, almost unfathomable order of complexity and vastness and power. And our psalmist invites us, we have to see ourselves in the light of creation, in the light of the expanse of the heavens. Why? Because it produces for us the kind of humility that is appropriate of creatures. See, we tend to think of ourselves as our own little gods running around controlling our own little universe. Nature tells us differently. Nature says there's something so vastly beyond you that you are, in one way, just a speck of sand in the ocean. And on the other hand, because you're in the image of God, you matter. Second is that appreciating the natural order produces a certain gratitude. So Psalm 19 begins, the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. And so just that whole idea there that we draw the line from the majesty of creation to the glory of the Creator, the amazing, the greatness of God, that's what's involved there. And that produces not only humility, but a sense of gratitude that such a God would have interest in us at all. And then one of my favorite psalms, Psalm 111, which says, great are the works of the Lord. They are studied by all who delight in them. Splendid and majestic is his work. And it's just that idea that as we apply ourselves to understanding the way that God made the world, it invites us into his own thinking, into his own mind. Never could that be said in any human age greater than in our own, in the age of DNA, where we have actually been able to penetrate down into the very language of life itself. And to discover that is an awesome and overwhelming reality. So nature matters because it reflects who God is. And we must see ourselves in the light of what God has made. Now let's talk, secondly, about spirituality in a material world. As I said a minute ago, this is the real sticking point for the world's religions. We don't know how to live in the world, the physical world. In the Eastern faiths, as they were originally conceived, the world itself is nothing other than an illusion, that the only thing that exists is the spiritual. Throughout history, it's always been this discomfort between my soul stuck in a material body that I must find release from. Certainly, that's been an important part, unfortunately, of how Christian spirituality has been practiced over the centuries, as though somehow this world is the veil of tears. We're stuck in our body, and we need to find, you know, a way to diminish the role of the body so that the spirit can thrive. How different that is from the biblical view. Nature matters. This is important because people matter. When we talk about spirituality in a material world, we can never extract the human component. Nature does matter. It's super important for us to get because people matter and they matter to God. Think about the reality of ecology and justice. This is something that we don't really talk about very much in this fellowship. And yet God is making a covenant with nature. How kind of a covenant? An everlasting covenant. He seems to care very much about his created order. And indeed, so should we. Let's think about that. There are spiritual and ethical implications to how we view nature and how we handle our own ecology. Think of the legacy of exploitation. This is an aerial map of the island of Hispaniola. You know what that is? That's the Dominican Republic on the green side and Haiti on the brown side. What is going on? Well, it's called deforestation. It's the idea that here's an island full of really great timber. I got an idea. Let's go and take it. How much of it? Well, of course, all of it. And that's pretty much what happened under the colonial French rule. And that with that exploitation of the natural resources became impossible, more or less, to live on an island that is stripped of all of its topsoil, all of its trees, things like that. We wonder, what is wrong with this country? Well, that's a pretty good descriptive picture of it. Right there. And the legacy of colonialism largely is the legacy of exploitation. And it's not just that it's destroying the natural environment. It is doing that. But because people are connected to that environment, it destroys people. It destroys societies as well. That's an issue of justice. There's also, more subtly but very importantly, the reality of consumption and poverty. Not taking responsibility, not thinking wisely or justly about nature, just by virtue of our own consumptive habits in the developed world and in American society in particular. This is the reality that we need to be aware of. It's true. It's out there. Cornell University writes a chronicle every quarter, and in 1997, it was dedicated to this issue that's defined by this article that starts, U.S. Could feed more than 800 million people with the grain that our livestock eats. That's a reality. Nearly a billion people could have plenty of food to eat if they ate as well as our cows and pigs. Are people more important than cows and pigs? This would be the question that we would need to ask. Now, clearly, it doesn't mean that this is the only solution to hunger or poverty. I'm not suggesting that at all. What I am suggesting is that our consumptive habits have an effect on the availability that we have to meet the pressing real needs of human beings elsewhere. That is a reality. Peter Chapman wrote a book a couple years ago called Bananas, How the United Fruit Company Shaped the World. And that's really worth a read. And here's why. Because we love our bananas. You like bananas? I like bananas. They're full of potassium, and they taste good, and you put them in your yogurt, and it makes the yogurt tolerable, because you're not allowed to eat all that other stuff when you get old. But the reality is that cheap produce comes at a very high price in the places where it's grown. That is the reality of it. And that so enormous North American companies like United Fruit Company, Dole, things like that, find their way to control governments, to create vast expanses of land in Latin America and South America, places like that, more or less dispossessing peasants of their land so that we can create an ocean of banana farms. It's amazing. We were in Ecuador last fall, and just I felt like I was in Iowa farm country. Except for, no, these are banana trees that go on as far as the eye can see. And as you drive hour after hour, it doesn't go away. And we wonder, where are those bananas going? And they're going to your favorite Crozet or wherever. So that 80% of what that country produces ends up on our table, not theirs. That's the important part. That the things that would be important for their own economy, for their own livelihood, and for their own nutrition is sacrificed for the sake of North American consumption. Now, I'm not trying to make a big political thing out of this. I'm not telling you how you should think about it or vote about it, but I am telling you that's reality. And that is an issue of where justice corresponds with ecology. And it is important for us to have some frame of reference for how do we think about those issues. Just to say, I don't care, is saying something different than what God is saying, because God cares. God has entered into a covenant with nature, and we should be mindful of that. It should matter to us because it matters to Him. Are you with me? Does it feel a little uncomfortable to you? Like, what are you talking about? Can't we talk about something cool? This is important. And the lives of billions of people the quality of their lives hangs in the balance of how we are prepared to interact with those kinds of questions. Because it is the comfortable standard of living to which we have become accustomed that has in many ways created circumstances that are manifestly unfavorable to so much of the world around us. Okay? Now, let's move on. So there is a moral frame that we as Christians must have. Spiritually minded people have to look at the ethical implications of the stewardship of our earth because it affects people. There's also this other point that spirituality in a material world reflects on our own bodies. This is in part why God is saying to Noah, he says, this is a covenant for you and for your descendants as well. There's a human element of this, that God's interest in nature is in part an upholding of his value of the relationship that he created for us to begin with as embodied spirits, as people with a body and soul. Which brings us to the question of sex, as all things do. The purpose of sex is what? It's interesting how God frames this in the creation narrative. He says, in the image of God, he created man, male and female, he created them. In the image of God, okay, so here, God is a personal being. He's an eternal personal being, and he's not dependent on his creation to express his personality, right? Because creation's contingent upon him. He existed long before there was heaven and earth or anything else. It was him. But God exists in three persons as Father, Son, and Spirit. And so it is possible for an infinite God to also be personal and to express that personality in intimate relationship with himself. It's exactly what Jesus is praying in John chapter 17. The last night of his life, that the disciples would experience the unity that the Father and Son enjoyed before, he says, the creation ever was. To be personal is to be relational, by definition. And so the purpose of sexuality, it goes on to say in Genesis 2, is that so that the two people could become one, could become one flesh. And why does that matter? Because in that the way that God designed us to be as both spiritual and physical beings, it is through the sexual relationship that two individuals, two persons, distinct individuals, can come together and be one physically, emotionally, spiritually, that there is that bond that exists, and that's the importance of the sexual relationship. That's super important from the Bible's point of view, that we view the sexual relationship in this way. Christians, for centuries, really almost since the very beginning, have been very embarrassed about the concept, the talk about sex. And why is that? Well, there's lots of reasons for that we won't go into, but the point here is that there's an embarrassment that underlies this topic. And in the vacuum emerges ideas about sex that are not God's intent, that really rob us of the richness of that mind-body or spirit-body relationship that God intended for us to have. So in a fallen world where we're no longer doing things God's way, but we're going our own way, sexuality has become an opportunity for exploitation and for deep brokenness in people's lives. And this really, I think, speaks to the incredible importance of the sexual relationship because of the level of damage that it has created for people, right? If it were an inconsequential part of what it means to be a person, then being broken in this area would not be that big a deal. But this is so centrally important to how God made us as souls that are connected to a body, that to abuse the intent and the design for sexuality means that we're just broken on the anvil of our own device, of our own desires. And in our culture, where there just simply is no moral framework whatsoever for the sexual relationship, no wonder we are as broken and confused about sexuality as we are. And this is maybe one of the greatest examples of what's really wrong with our understanding of ourselves before God. Now, Paul says it like this. It was a problem. It's a problem for us. It's been a problem all the way along. And to the Corinthians, these guys, they had their sexual thing going on. There's a statement that they would make. The food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food. In other words, if you're hungry, eat. And if you're horny, that. But he says, yet the body is not for immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. So that what we do with our bodies actually has spiritual and moral implications. Not just the sense of guilt because I've ripped off yet another person or whatever, but there's something in our own spirit that is depleted and is diminished when we do not steward our bodies according to God's design. It's terrible. It's the reality of it. Let's make our last point then. God is blessing the earth with this covenant. Comes on the heels of his having cursed the earth with the flood. And it's important that we understand the relationship between those things. Why the curse? Why does God curse the earth? He makes the earth, he puts man there, and then he destroys with flood. What's the point there? The point is that the earth becomes a broader reflection of the human condition. That's the point. That why does God curse the ground? It's because that humanity, uniquely created in his image and as uniquely as moral agents, has defiled the environment that God places us in. The human dilemma is, according to the Bible, that we are far from God. That we have each gone our own way, we're doing our own thing, and that the consequence of that is that we live spiritually in a state of death. And ultimately, that we stand under the judgment of a God who is, in whose image we are made, but who is just and perfectly right, and we're not. So we've got a problem with acceptability before a God like this. And God takes that problem in the most serious way imaginable. What are we going to do with this? And so God is prepared to make shots over the bow to arrest our attention. The futility and pain of living in a world that is no longer operating according to the design that God had really orients us to our true condition. In the narrative in Genesis chapter 3, and then again in chapter 5, verse 29, it says that God cursed the ground. He made the work of the ground futile. Why did he do that? Is it just because he's like, I'll make you pay for violating my will or whatever? It's not cynical like that. That's not the point. The point is that humanity lives in a state of death. And what will bring the reality of our condition to our attention more palpably than the futility and pain of living in a material world that's broken? That's the point. So when we see our bodies beginning to break down, what's the first thought that comes to us? I'm not going to live forever, right? I had lunch with my mother and father-in-law. I'll have lunch with my mom tomorrow. The average age of the three of them is like 89 or something like that. You know, they're old. And there is not a single day that goes by for them where they're not thinking about the fact that this might be my last day. And in that sense, they're a little bit closer to understanding reality than most of us here tonight. Most of us live under the illusion of being eternal. We just don't lift our thoughts to beyond the abstract that, of course, I'll die someday. But what about the reality of that? What about the reality of our condition? That this body that we live in, just like our inner life, is going to run out. And so God, I like the way C.S. Lewis puts it in The Problem of Pain. C.S. Lewis is the author of the Chronicles of Narnia series, the children's stories, but he was also a super insightful Christian thinker. And he wrote a series of lectures to the Christian church in the 1940s and 50s, and one of them is The Problem of Pain, where he begins to engage this question of human suffering. And he says, he points it like this. He's talking about the death of his own wife with cancer. And he says, you know, here's the thing, that God whispers to us in our pleasures. You know, pleasure does provide us indication that that there's something remarkable and beautiful in the human experience. Things that animals cannot imagine, but humans can. Beauty, pleasure, things like this. And God, he says, speaks to us in our pleasures. He whispers to us in our pleasures. But he shouts to us in our pain. Pain, he says, is God's megaphone to arrest a stilled spirit against him. And I feel like that is true. It's when things aren't working for us and our bodies are breaking down and there are problems with the world around us that it does raise the possibility that there is actually a problem and that that's a problem that I'm going to have to deal with. And that is the point of the thing, is that God allows us to suffer in the material so that we would be alerted to the reality of our own spiritual condition before him, which is why I think so many of us found our way to trusting in Christ in the context of adversity. God got our attention to think more clearly about what the human condition really is. And so I want to call out to you here tonight who are maybe thinking about these kinds of issues. Maybe you haven't stepped inside of a church or been in front of a Bible study or something like this for a really long time. And you've got some tread worn off the sole of your shoes. And you're kind of wondering, okay, here I am, and what's it all about? Where do we go from here? In a certain way, I'm at this crossroads where on the one hand, the pain that I experience is leading me to a conclusion that this is just the most futile existence possible. On the other hand, it's making me wonder, is this all there is and maybe there's something I'm missing? And I'm just here to say that, yeah, there is something that you're missing. What you're missing is the voice of God calling to you through your confusion, through your pain, through the things that are going on in your life to say, this is a big picture of what's really going on inside, that you've got a problem with me and you know in your heart that you do. That you're just as broken inwardly as your body is outwardly. But there's good news, and which is that God cares about you enough to enter into your world, to take upon himself the burden of your guilt, so that through Christ he can offer you forgiveness, he can offer you reconciliation with himself, and this is pretty important, the promise of regeneration, life coming out of death. Let's move on to that point. The meaning of salvation is regeneration. We are not disembodied spirits. Here's the thing. We're not that way. It is true. Paul says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. But we also know that at the end of the day, at the end of the age, our bodies also will be resurrected. That's an important part of salvation. But the view of salvation that we're provided for in the scripture is a material thing. We're not those angels floating around on the clouds with the harps and that type of thing. Man, that would be boring. Oh my God. I think of a different place where that happens. With the H-E double hockey sticks thing. That would be hell. But no. God says, in Isaiah 60, verse 21, and there's so many other passages like this, he says, they will possess the land forever. The branch of my planting, the work of my hands, that I may be glorified. It's my intent for my people at the end of when all this thing is resolved, when my plan of salvation is complete, that my people will be on that land that I promised them forever. So eternity is there's a physical thing about eternity, and there's a land, and our bodies again are resurrected. Romans 8, verse 23, the creation itself will be set free. We ourselves, Paul says, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoption as God's children, the redemption of our body. And so God cares about our bodies. God cares about the liberation of creation itself. Creation will experience a regeneration, an exodus of their own, a redemption, because it will come ultimately under the rule of God. And that's how the picture of salvation emerges from this very early chapter in the Old Testament's story or narrative of salvation. God has intended a plan for the whole thing, for all of the cosmos. And we get to be a part of that, and it's pretty awesome. So what do we do about that? Just a last thought by way of application. I do feel that many of us, because we are not experiencing physical deprivation, because things in life come to us fairly easily, don't tend to think about or are very cognizant of the vast majority of the world for whom things are much more difficult. And a passage like what we're studying here this evening is an important part of our witness, understanding that we need to move toward people with the love of God, with a message that is embodied in what we do and not merely in what we say, and that the circumstances of people's lives is a spiritual issue for a God who cares about nature. Okay. Who cares about the conditions that people are having to live in. And it is an important part of our communication of the gospel that we are also bringing resources that people's bodies need. Because why? Because these are God's things anyway. And as just stewards of the resources of God, He calls on us to move toward those who are in need with those resources in His name for the sake of coherent, balanced Christian witness. And I think that's an important part of our own mission program here. It's really an important part of who we are and our stewardship of the vast resources that God has given to us. Let me make this final point and then we'll close. God blesses His people for the purpose of being a blessing. Next week, we're going to look at the contract that God writes up, not with Noah, but with Abraham. And He says to Abraham, He says, just a little sneak preview, He says He's going to bless him, and then He says, "Then and you will be a blessing. And you will be a blessing." And the flow is really clear. I'm blessing you, Abraham, so that I can bless others, and indeed bless the entire human race. And why has God blessed you the way He has? So that we can find ways to steward those awesome resources, to come alongside the vast majority of a humanity that doesn't have the access to the very same things that we do. 2/3 of a billion people today don't have fresh water accessible to him, and all of the deprivations that involves. Most people in the world today are really living at a level that is vastly below where we are. And it is part of our Christian testimony to be concerned for the earth and the stewarding of those resources. And that's basically all I got to say about that.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.